Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on biodiesel and alternative energy right after this. You know, Charles Lyell, one of the pillars of modern geology, published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most who believe them don't even know who it was that originated them. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins was devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes back through time indefinitely. That way, catastrophes like Noah's flood are ruled out, and all of this is called science. Well, listen to this. The sun is shrinking. That's right. A Newswire report made the surprising statement, quote, "The sun's diameter appears to have been decreasing by about 0.1% per century. Scientists have been watching for over 100 years now, and the evidence is conclusive. Every hour, the sun is shrinking about 5 feet. Now, if the sun is shrinking 0.1% per century, then it totals 1% per millennium. If the sun existed only 100,000 years ago, it would have been double its present diameter. Then, extrapolate that back 20 million years ago, and the surface of the sun would be touching the Earth 93 million miles in diameter. And as far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage has been consistent since the origin of the sun. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the dinosaurs' extinction? Do you remember that story? 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs died out. But 20 million years ago, the diameter of the sun was 93 million miles, and it was touching the Earth. Now, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on these kinds of pseudoscientific lies. And that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda masquerading under the guise of science. Now, for more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. And you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. And if you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time I told you that the price of gasoline in the United States is $4.03 a gallon. So let me put up or shut up. Here are the hidden costs of a gallon of gasoline in America. $4.03, that's what every one of us pay. I pointed out to you the government subsidizes food, so the price that you're paying for food is about 20% less than the real price. Now, what U.S. drivers pay to fill their tanks varies slightly by location, and it reflects the cost of turning crude oil into gasoline that is sold at more than 130,000 outlets coast to coast and border to border. Now, external costs are harder to nail down. Estimates vary very widely. But hidden gas costs are these. Leaking oil from refineries and distribution centers is 2 cents per gallon. Then the risk of macroeconomic disruptions, temporary oil shortages, lead to short-term disruptions in employment. That costs 12 cents a gallon. Global warming cost of carbon emissions, 40 cents a gallon. Local pollution, tailpipe emissions, effects on respiratory health, especially among vulnerable populations, 80 cents a gallon. Traffic accidents, 80 cents a gallon. Excuse me. Global warming, let me run that one up there, is 12 cents. Local pollution is 40 cents. And traffic accidents is 80 cents per gallon. And then the big one here, congestion. Value of time lost in traffic jams and fuel wasted is $1 a gallon. Now, biodiesel is the product that's made from corn oil, soybean oil, sunflower, canola oil. And in fact, I told you a little story here about a guy that goes around to the fast food restaurants and gets their cooking oil, filters it, and then burns it in his pickup. Well, that's illegal because you're not paying the fuel tax. And if you get caught doing that, in other words, if you were running a big truck, see, out here on the farm, we have colored gas. Well, it's colored diesel. And if they catch you running the wrong color in your fuel tanks, you see, then they fine you raise hell with you, so you want to tuck that one away in your heart. Now, you can make all of this alternative fuel that you want and burn it on your own farm. That's not a problem. It's when you stick it in your pickup and go out on the highway. That's where you're out there burning fuel and you're not paying your fuel tax. And that's why they want this biodiesel to be regulated and controlled by government. Now, here's a story on biodiesel. The use of vegetable oil in compression ignition engines is not new. Rudolf Diesel, who was credited with inventing the diesel engine, first used peanut oil as fuel. You see, they hadn't made any diesel fuel yet. However, the petroleum-based fuel we now call diesel fuel soon became the fuel of choice because of economic advantage. Until political unrest made availability questionable and air pollution became a concern, very little consideration was given to alternative fuels. In 1974, when unrest in the oil-rich Middle East threatened crude oil supplies, it became apparent that other countries dependent on imported oil could quickly be deprived of necessary fuel. At present, the U.S. has about 4.4% of the proven world petroleum reserves, but consumes 25% of the world oil supply. And as a result, research on alternative fuels was funded and old research information was retrieved. Now, we're burning, that is worldwide now, we're burning about 30 billion barrels of oil per year. If you want to take some of these numbers down, the Alberta tar sands, if you want to know how much oil is available in the world right now, up in Alberta, they got 1.6 trillion barrels of tar sand oil. The world has proven reserves of 1 trillion barrels worldwide. The western United States has 3.7 trillion barrels of oil. Now, that's 6.3 trillion barrels total that we know about. That's a 210-year supply at 30 billion barrels a year worldwide. So when we're talking about peak oil, keep in mind that there's a lot of cheap, easy oil to get. That's the trillion barrels that's already been identified. More than likely, over the next 30 to 60 years, we would find another trillion barrels in the world. More than likely. But of course, with the government restrictions and taxes, and you got the environmentalists, and you know, you put all these people together with taxes, environmentalists, and it's going to impact upon the availability of oil to find. And of course, there's a lot of unrest in the world, and the population of the world is doubling every 30 years. And you put all these factors together, every gallon that we can save, produce, or use outside of the petroleum reserves stretches the world's reserves and America's reserves one more gallon. I'm all in favor of conservation. I'm all in favor of drilling in the Arctic National Refuge. And I'm all in favor of environmental protections. I think the Peabody Coal Company ought to reclaim the land that they strip mine. And I think that the oil companies ought to restore the land that they drill on. All right, so now what's the problem? I reject this argument that it's either or, that it's either you drill oil and destroy the land or you don't destroy the land and you can't drill for oil. I say we can do both. I'm a businessman. Now, the Persian Gulf War back in 1991 reminded us that the U.S. cannot rely solely on foreign oil for fuel to produce, process, and distribute food and feed products. The need to be self-sufficient and to have a reliable energy source now seems important enough to look beyond simple economic comparison. Well, I think that's a pipe dream. Like I said, and I think it was last time, you got oil in Saudi Arabia coming out of the ground free. There's no pumps over there. They don't pump the oil out. It comes out under pressure. If we were to produce or develop our shale oil, it'll cost $30 to $60 a barrel, and you got to tear up the land and do a lot of work to get it. Nobody wants to do that. You'd have to change your economic policy. You'd have to change your free trade policies, and you know nobody's going to do that. The oil companies, the environmentalists, and the politicians are working together in this program. So you can forget about these people working together for the benefit of mankind and poor Americans and Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. These people are working together for their own agendas. Now, the chemical structure of this vegetable oil, an organic acid ester, is a glycerin molecule with up to three fatty acids linked to it with ester linkages. In past research, several states have conducted research on the feasibility of biodiesel fuel. Scientists in North Dakota have investigated expelling, degumming, and esterifying oil from sunflower seed. Idaho scientists have investigated rapeseed oil, developing a relatively simple procedure for esterification. Rapeseed oil, which is used for industrial processes, contains a level of acid that is detrimental to animal feed, so low uric, E-R-U-C-I-C, uric or something acid varieties called canola have been developed. In general, research information on rapeseed, that's canola oil, is applicable to canola oil. Now, let me give you some numbers here and I'll tell you about how this is going to come out. Now, we produce about 3.8 billion, it's rounded off to 4 billion bushels of soybeans a year here in the United States. And the oil that comes out of those, you get about a gallon per bushel. You get about 30 bushels to the acre. I think it's 38 bushels to the acre, something like that. So round it off to 40 bushels to the acre, and you get about a gallon per bushel. So you get about 40 gallons of oil per acre. Now, keep this in mind, that if you're going to put more acreage into oil-producing plants, then you got to have more chemical fertilizers, or you got to practice land Sabbaths and Jubilees. Now, you know, people aren't going to practice land Sabbaths and Jubilees, so we got to have more chemical farming. More chemical farming creates more pollution. Now, we use about 36 billion gallons of diesel in the United States. That's 35 or 36 billion. And if you take all of the available acreage, you know, 3.8 billion bushels, you can only get 3.8 billion gallons of oil out of all of the soybeans. So, you know, 4 to 36 leaves you 32 billion gallons short. And that's assuming that you take all of the available soybeans and convert it to oil. Well, hang on, we got to take a break here. We'll be back with more on biodiesel and alternative fuels right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to the homeschooling page on my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. All right, I'm talking about biodiesel. And biodiesel is simply vegetable oil. Rudolf Diesel, when he invented the diesel engine, used peanut oil as the first fuel in the diesel engine. After he showed that the engine worked, well, then, of course, the petroleum company said, well, we think we can make something cheaper and better than peanut oil. They did. It's called diesel fuel, and we use 36 billion gallons a year here in the United States. We produce about, or we could produce, about 3.8 billion gallons of soybean oil. That means that we would have to take all of the acreage that we now have devoted to soybeans, multiply that times 9 to dedicate that much acreage, that much ground to producing our fuel. And that soybean, remember, a bushel of soybeans sells for $6, and you get a little over a gallon out of each bushel. I think it's 1.4. So, you know, you're talking about some pretty expensive diesel fuel there, wouldn't you say? You know, $4, $5, $6 a gallon. I don't think that's very economical, and as long as the Arabs have got oil over there, I think we'd probably prefer doing that. Now, there is a bright spot here called hydrogen. Now, hydrogen gives you 279%, so a gallon of hydrogen gives you almost three times as much power. So if you were getting 20 miles to the gallon on your gas engine or diesel engine, and you could convert that to hydrogen, you could get 60 miles to the gallon with hydrogen. I think hydrogen has a whole lot more prospects than does ethanol, which only gives you 40% of the power of gasoline. 40%. First of all, it takes a gallon of ethanol to produce 1.34 gallons to use. So you have a net benefit of 3/4 of a gallon, or excuse me, 3/400 of a gallon, about a third of a gallon. So you have to burn 3 gallons of ethanol in order to get a gallon of ethanol to burn in your car, and then it's only 40% as powerful as the gasoline. And we'd have to take all of the corn production in the United States, multiply that times 82 to get the equivalent of 135 billion gallons of gasoline. I'm not saying it isn't worth doing. If there's any scrap corn left out there and you can convert it into some kind of fuel and we don't have to buy it from the Arabs, I'm all for it. But I'm giving you the numbers here so that you can see that these environmentalists who are opposed to drilling for oil here in the United States, and they don't have a viable plan. They say, well, we need to use solar power, solar energy. Well, okay. Let me show you what that costs. I'm doing a little cost analysis here on my farm. We're thinking about putting in solar power, and actually, on our farm, where we pay $300 a month in power bills, we can put in a solar operation, and it'll cost us $40,000, and it'll pay for itself in roughly, you know, roughly 10 years. Now, the useful life of these solar panels and the batteries and everything that goes into it is about 20 years. So you can just about double your money in 20 years. By investing 40, we would save 80. So solar technology is now getting to the point where it's just about economically feasible to do it. I think if we can get the cost of it down to around $30,000 for putting it in, and $300 a month. That'll just about make economic sense. So tuck that one away in your heart. I'm all for solar power. Hey, listen, if we can use solar power, let's do it. But right now, solar power is a little on the pricey side. And it's a little dicey to put in. It's not something that's just all that simple, you know, that you just pull these pieces off the shelf. You don't just go down to Home Depot, pick up the pieces, and come home and put it together, a do-it-yourself operation. That's my point. All right, now there's another thing that I could point out. In California, they've got a place at Geyserville, up in Northern California, where they've got hot geysers coming out of the ground. Well, all over the West, like Yellowstone Park, a number of places in Idaho, you can drill down into the Earth's mantle, and there's hot magma underneath. And what they do there in Geyserville, they drilled some holes. They don't have to go down too deep. I think it's 1,600 feet. And they can tap steam. And if they got hot rocks, they pump water down there, convert it to steam, and then use the steam to run turbines. I don't know how much electricity comes out of Geyserville, but there is an alternative energy source. Now, take a look at the big island of Hawaii. Why don't the power companies over there drill into the magma at the foot of the volcano and build a power plant out there and supply the power, just like they do, PG&E does in California, Geyserville? There's wind power, and that's great. We ought to put up windmills every place we can and take the power off of it. But the point that I'm making is right now, wind power amounts to less than 1% of the electric power in the United States. Now, that's good, because 99% of our power comes from coal and other sources and uses. 1% comes from wind power, and it's renewable. And sure, I agree with you. I think we should have 2%, and then 4%, and then 8%. Nuclear power, for some reason, the environmentalists are just down on nuclear power. The French are producing 60% of their power. The Japanese, around 80% of their power from nuclear energy. Well, if the French and the Japs can do it, why can't we Americans do it? We spend all of our time fighting among ourselves with, well, whoa, gee, what are we going to do with the spent rods? What are the Japs doing with their spent rods? What are the French doing? See, the environmentalists don't have a solution to the problem. To them, they can't figure out a way to solve the problem, so let's not have nuclear energy. And I'm a businessman, and I think in terms of, gee, how can we have nuclear energy, and how can we solve the problem of the spent rods? Why can't we kill two birds with one stone? Well, in the marketplace, you can. But when you have central planning in Washington, which is what you have in America today, you can't do that. So that's the problem there. Now, let me give you one more story here. I think that you'll be... You'll just be tickled to death here to know that, looking at the economic comparisons, diesel fuel is sold on a per gallon basis, while soy oil sells by the pound. So for comparison, we need some equivalent basis, such as volume or BTU content. Now consider a volume basis. Soy ester weighs 7.7 pounds per gallon. Number two diesel fuel weighs 7.1 pounds per gallon. So if soy ester can be substituted on a one-to-one basis with diesel fuel, 7.7 times the price per pound for soy ester would equal the price per gallon for diesel fuel, or 0.13 times the price per gallon of diesel fuel would equal the price per pound for soy ester. So, for example, if soy ester cost 20 cents per pound, the equivalent cost for diesel fuel would be $1.54. Or if diesel fuel costs $1 a gallon, the equivalent cost per pound for soy ester would be 13 cents a pound. Well, $1.54 would be all right, but you see, soybeans, if you're going to grow them, 38 bushels to the acre, you got to get $6 a bushel in order to make a profit. And I don't care whether you use the soybeans for mayonnaise or you use the soybeans to power your pickup. As a farmer, I got to have $6 or $7 a bushel, which means then that the price of that oil that comes out of those bushels of soybeans is going to have to be somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 or $5 a gallon. You know, we can use petroleum. Number two diesel right now is around $1.75 in my neck of the woods, or $2 a gallon. So I think we got to get down to something that's economical. Now, it could be that there's other products that can be grown, such as safflower, sunflower, rapeseed, or something else. But the moral to my story is this, boys and girls, you just can't economically meet the $2 a gallon diesel with peanut oil or soybean oil, which is $4 to $6 a gallon. And that's where reality's at. Since diesel fuel contains more heat energy per gallon than soy ester, a one-to-one comparison may not quite be fair. Using the values from Table 1 and Number 2, diesel fuel contains 138,400 BTUs to the gallon, soy ester about 132,900. So about 1.04 gallons of soy ester would be required to perform the same work as 1 gallon of diesel fuel. So on an energy basis, soy ester at 20 cents a pound would be equivalent to diesel fuel at about $1.60 a gallon. Now, the potential oil yield for soybeans is about 18%. That is, from a bushel of soybeans weighing 60 pounds, 10.8 pounds of oil can be removed. The remaining meal may be sold for about $185 a ton, or 9.25 cents per pound. Oil yield from canola and sunflower ranges from 40 to 45%. So about 50 gallons of oil per acre is what you're going to get with soybeans. That's 359 pounds of oil per ton. At $210 per acre, that's about $6 a bushel. That's what you're getting for soybeans today, $46.74 per ton, $4 per gallon for soybean oil, 35 bushels per acre on soybeans in round numbers. So the soybean oil is going to cost you about double what number two diesel costs you today. So they're talking about, well, gee, could we put it in as a mixture? Well, listen, you farmers out there, row croppers, you could put in 10 acres. And you don't really care, because it's how much does it cost you to put in 10 acres of sunflowers, and 10 acres will run a 500-acre farm. Now, you take all of your fuel bill, what does that cost you every year, you know, $5,000, $10,000, whatever you're spending, and then say, well, what is it going to cost me to farm 10 acres, thrash it, squeeze it, filter it, and then start burning that in my tractors and my pickups so that I don't have to spend my cash out here? And maybe it's economical. I don't know whether it is or not. It's certainly not going to be economical to put it out in the marketplace and start selling it at the pump. But when you're talking about farming, you know, and what is the cost savings in cash to me? Taking 10 acres and converting that to oil so that you don't have to spend $10,000 on fuel to run your farm could be cost efficient, cost effective. Well, we got to take another break here, so hang on and we'll take another little break, and we'll come back, and I've got a story here to tell you about sustainable oil. Maybe we're not running out of oil as fast as we thought. Stand by. I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, Charles Lyell, one of the pillars of modern geology, published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Well, Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe in them don't even know who it was that originated them, but now you know it's Charles Lyell. And from Lyell's system of reasoning, a doctrine of origins has been devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes that we observe today back through time indefinitely. And that way we can eliminate catastrophes like Noah's flood. They're strictly ruled out, and then we call this process evolutionary philosophy. It's called science. Well, listen to this, Niagara Falls. This famous waterfall is a magnificent example of a geologic clock that reveals a very young Earth. And that's because the rim of the falls is wearing back at a known rate every year. And geologists recognize that it has only taken about 5,000 years for Niagara Falls to erode from its original precipice. And what did our teachers tell us about the extinction of dinosaurs? Remember, they told us that was 65 million years ago. Now, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on these pseudoscientific lies called evolution. And it's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the banner of science. And this is one of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School that I conduct twice a year here in Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. Call and order yours right now. The number's 417-273-4967. And if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email. Send me an email request for that free general law CD package. It's easy enough, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, I've got an article here published in the Powerhouse, the Ecologic Powerhouse, for September 2004. If you'd like to subscribe, it's the Ecologic Powerhouse, 1200 North White Sands Boulevard, Suite 110, Alamogordo, New Mexico, 88310. If you're wondering why would I want to, well, this powerhouse is the free market opposite to the greenies and the feminazis and the what's old Rush call those ecologists there, ecological nuts of some kind. Well, this is a conservative property rights format type ecological magazine. It's called the Ecologic Powerhouse. And I don't know what the price of this is. Why don't you write them a letter or call them? It's 1200 North White Sands Boulevard, Suite 110, Alamogordo, New Mexico, 88310. Well, they put out an article this month called Sustainable Oil. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, they used to tell us that this oil was an organic product that came from dinosaurs. And the dinosaurs got buried, and over time, their fat on them, I guess, turned into petroleum, and there you are, we have petroleum. That's the story I heard. And, of course, there's a lot of it, because if you take a trillion barrels of oil, How much oil is that? Well, to give you an idea, you know where the Aswan Dam is in Egypt, and there's a big lake behind it called Lake Nasser? Well, Lake Nasser has 1 trillion barrels of water in it. So you take all of that, Lake Nasser. That's how much oil is in the world today, proven reserves, 1 trillion barrels. We Americans in our oil shale have 3.7 of those Lake Nassers sealed up in that oil shale. And you Canadians have 1.6 of those Lake Nassers there in Alberta, stuck out there in your oil sands, that tar sand, whatever you call it. Well, this article on sustainable oil goes like this. About 80 miles off the coast of Louisiana lies a mostly submerged mountain, the top of which is known as Eugene Island. The portion underwater is an eerie-looking sloping tower jutting up from the depths of the Gulf of Mexico, with deep fissures and perpendicular faults which spontaneously spew forth natural gas. A significant reservoir of crude oil was discovered nearby in the late 1960s. And by 1970, a platform named Eugene 330 was busily producing about 15,000 barrels a day of high-quality crude oil. Well, by the late 1980s, the platform's production had slipped to less than 4,000 barrels a day, and the well was considered pumped out, done. Suddenly, in 1990, production soared back to 15,000 barrels a day, and the reservoirs, which had been estimated at 60 million barrels in the 1970s, were recalculated up to 400 million barrels. Now, interestingly, the measured geological age of the new oil was quantifiably different than the oil that they were pumping in the 1970s. Now, that's pretty important. Let me read that again. Interestingly enough, the measured geologic age of the new oil was quantifiably different than the oil pumped in the 1970s. So put yourself into the story here. In the 1960s, they find an oil pool in the Gulf of Mexico, and they go drill into it. And they take a look at the oil, and it's got a chemical composition. They pump on it for 20 years, and the oil runs out. And then inexplicably, in 1990, oil production soars back to 15,000 barrels a day, and the composition, the chemical composition of this oil is different than the oil that they had been pumping out in the past. Well, and that tells you that some kind of a new source of oil has come back into the reservoir. So, you know, maybe there was another reservoir below it or off to the side of it, and as they pumped it out, it broke the rocks and flew into the one where they're pumping or something on that order. Well, they've got a theory here. Analysis of seismic recordings revealed the presence of a deep fault at the base of the Eugene Island Reservoir, which was gushing up a river of oil from some deeper and previously unknown source. So they got to looking at their charts and graphs and one thing and another, says, gosh, we've got a fault down here that's cracked open, and now oil from deeper down in the earth is gushing up into this reservoir that we're pumping out of. Now, similar results were seen at other Gulf of Mexico oil wells, and similar results were found in the Cook Inlet oil fields in Alaska. Similar results were found in oil fields in Uzbekistan, and similarly in the Middle East, where oil exploration and extraction have been underway for at least 20 years. Known reserves have doubled in these previously thought used oil fields. All right, now, let's get this again. In Uzbekistan, the Gulf of Mexico, Cook Inlet, these known reserves that they've been pumping on for years and years have suddenly rejuvenated themselves. The soil has a different chemical composition. Now, oil fields don't do that everywhere, but several of these oil fields have. Why? What's going on here? Well, creating that much oil would take a big pile of dead dinosaurs and fermenting prehistoric plants. Now, could there be another source for crude oil? Well, an intriguing theory now permeating oil company research staffs suggests that crude oil may actually be a natural inorganic product, not a stepchild of unfathomable time and organic degradation. The theory suggests that there may be huge yet to be discovered reservoirs and reserves of oil at depths that dwarf current world estimates. Now, the theory is fairly simple. Crude oil forms as a natural inorganic process which occurs between the mantle and the crust, somewhere between 5 and 20 miles deep. The proposed mechanism for the formation of this oil is as follows. Methane, CH4, is a common molecule found in quantity throughout our solar system. Huge concentrations exist at great depth in the Earth. At the mantle-crust interface, roughly 20,000 feet beneath the surface, rapidly rising streams of compressed methane-based gases hit pockets of high temperature, causing the condensation of heavier hydrocarbons. The product of this condensation is commonly known as crude oil. Some compressed methane-based gases migrate into pockets and reservoirs we extract as natural gas. In the geologically cooler, more tectonically stable regions around the world, the crude oil pools into reservoirs. In the hotter, more volcanic, and tectonically active areas, the oil and natural gas continue to condense and eventually oxidize, producing carbon dioxide and steam, which exits from active volcanoes. Periodically, depending on variations of geology, the Earth, and its movements, oil seeps to the surface in quantity, creating the vast oil sand deposits of Canada and Venezuela, or the continental seeps found beneath the Gulf of Mexico and Uzbekistan. Periodically, depending on variations of geology, the vast deep pools of oil break free and replenish existing known reserves of oil. You ever heard that story before? I'd never heard that until I just read it in the ecologic, what do they call this thing here, the ecologic powerhouse. Now, this ecologic powerhouse is put out, see if I got Paragon Foundation, I think that's their address. And what we're dealing with here is we're dealing with the conservative side of the Greens. We're dealing with the ranchers and the businessmen of the ecological movement. Now, not everybody, in fact, I think just about everybody is in favor of ecology. I think everybody is in favor of cleaning up Lake Erie. And I'm in favor of let's not pollute the Mississippi River. And I'm a businessman. And I'm all in favor of drilling oil wells and doing business. In fact, I can't see anything wrong with putting a geothermal power plant right in the middle of Yosemite Park or right in the middle of Yellowstone Park. What's the problem? But you know, you got these ecologists and they say, oh my God, we can't have that. All right, you got roads that run all over Yellowstone Park. I can't see why we can't have a power plant down one of those roads. It's free energy, geothermal. Stand by. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective, 7 days a week. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are believed to be true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program and often endorses and recommends books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we recommend or endorse will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans who do not endorse the opinions or beliefs expressed here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. All right, we're talking about biodiesel and alternative energy, and I just before I took this break here, said, you know, I'm all in favor of putting power plants right in Yellowstone Park. You know, they've got geothermal pools up there. I don't know how much power is available up there, but when we talk about alternative energy abounds in Yellowstone and all over the West in geothermal pools. They're all over Idaho. And there's no reason why you can't tap into them, just like PG&E did there at the geysers at Geyserville in California. And if we were to get busy and double the amount of wind generators, we could produce 2% of our electricity through wind power. If we'd get off of our government regulation and produce nuclear power, you know, we could eliminate, and keep this in mind, we could eliminate most of the pollution that's associated with the burning of coal. Coming out of Wyoming, down Highway 30 are four tracks on the Union Pacific Railroad, and those four tracks have one coal train with 109 cars every 15 minutes. Headed eastbound, well, on three tracks, they're headed eastbound, delivering coal to these power plants. Now, I don't mind burning the coal, but wouldn't it make more sense to burn nuclear energy instead? Not only is it efficient, not only is it cheap, nobody's been killed yet with one of them. And the environmentalists are always beating the gong about the potential of the China syndrome. My God, we might have a Chernobyl. But we haven't, have we? And you know, if it was like the French and the Japanese, you know, they've got good power plants. They haven't had any problems. They haven't had any accidents, producing around 60 to 80% of their power. And they have to because they don't have the foreign exchange to buy all of this oil from the Arabs, and neither do we. And there's going to be a very radical, sudden readjustment of our economics in the United States as a result of our prolific ways. But listen to the balance of this article here. I'm talking about oil. It could well be that this oil is inexhaustible, or practically so. There are a number of observations across the oil-producing regions of the world that support this theory. And the list of proponents begins with Mendeleev, who created the periodic table of elements, and includes Dr. Thomas Gold, founding director of Cornell University Center for Radiophysics and Space Research, Dr. J.F. Kinney of Gas Resources Corporation of Houston, Texas. And in his 1999 book called The Deep Hot Biosphere, Dr. Gold presents compelling evidence for inorganic oil formation. And he notes that geologic structures where oil is found all correspond to deep earth formations, not the haphazard depositions that we find with sedimentary rock, associated fossils, or even current surface life. And he also notes that oil extracted from varying depths from the same oil field have the same chemistry. Oil chemistry does not vary as fossils vary with increasing depth. And also, interestingly enough, is the fact that oil is found in huge quantities among geographic formations where assays of prehistoric life are not sufficient to produce the existing reservoirs of oil. So where then did all of the oil come from? And from where is all of this new oil coming into these reservoirs? Where is it coming from? Another interesting fact is that every oil field throughout the world has outgassing helium. Now, helium is so often present in oil fields that helium detectors are used as oil prospecting tools. Helium is an inert gas known to be a fundamental product of the radiological decay of uranium and thorium, identified in quantity at great depths below the surface of the Earth, 200 and more miles below the surface of the Earth, and it's not found in meaningful quantities in areas that are not producing methane, oil, or natural gas. It's not a member of the dozen or so common elements associated with life, and it is found throughout the solar system and is a thoroughly inorganic product. So in these oil fields, we find a lot of helium for some reason, which is the product of the process of the decaying of uranium. Not exactly clear why, but it's there. So when you're drilling and you run into helium, then you can be pretty sure that you're going to run into oil. Not exactly clear why, but that's the association. Now, even more intriguing is evidence that several oil reservoirs around the world are refilling themselves, such as the Eugene Island Reservoir in the Gulf of Mexico, not from the sides, as you would expect from concurrent organic reservoirs, but from the bottom up. It's coming in from the bottom. And Dr. Gold strongly believes that oil is a renewable, primordial soup continually being manufactured by the Earth under ultra-hot conditions and tremendous pressures deep within the Earth's crust. As this substance migrates toward the surface, it is attacked by bacteria, making it appear to have an organic origin dating back to the dinosaurs. Now, smaller oil companies and innovative teams are using this theory to justify deep oil drilling in Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico, among other locations, with some success. Dr. Kinney is on record predicting that parts of Siberia contain a deep reservoir of oil equal to or exceeding that already discovered in the Middle East. Now, that's a pretty important statement. Listen to that again. Smaller oil companies and innovative teams are using this theory to justify deep oil drilling in Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico, among other locations, and with some success. Dr. Kinney is on record predicting that parts of Siberia contain deep reservoirs of oil equal to or exceeding that already discovered in the Middle East. My God, that's another trillion barrels of oil. You know, that's another 33-year supply. You know, how do these ecologists know that up here in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge that there's only 6 billion barrels? You see, the oil companies went up there and explored. They set off some explosives, and they said, yeah, we found oil, and there's oil down there, and we think there's 6 billion barrels. What if there's 60 billion or 600 billion? What if it's another one of those pools that refurbishes itself from deep subterranean primordial soups? I mean, you know, you don't know until you go in and look. And that's my objection to these greenies, is that they're obstructionists. They're obstructionists without a plan. They're not like Kerry. You know, Kerry's got a plan for everything. If there's a problem, Kerry's got a plan. And I'm sitting here as a businessman, and I say, well, why don't we go up there and look and find it? Let's drill and get the 6 billion barrels out. And somebody says, well, my God, this is pristine primordial wilderness. Where is it located? Up on the Arctic Ocean. And I'm sitting here saying, well, when was the last time you went up on the Arctic Ocean to view this pristine wilderness? And are you planning to go up there and view it? You know, we've got a few of these rich ecology people, like Senator Kerry, who have the money to go up there and view this wilderness, and they seem that, you know, maybe there's 100 of them, or 200, or 2,000, and these 2,000 or 3,000 people want to do us out of the oil and the needs that we have here, so that they can maintain this pristine wilderness for a handful of ecology elites. That's what that boils down to, doesn't it? Now, the oil companies have all said that they could go up there and drill that oil and not leave a footprint, and I'm saying we'll hold them to it. Well, going on, they say here it was assumed, or he was quoted as stating that, competent physicists, chemists, chemical engineers, and men knowledgeable of thermodynamics have known that natural petroleum does not evolve from biological materials since the last quarter of the 19th century. Now, when I went to public school, they were still teaching evolution, so they taught me that it came out of dinosaurs. But since the last quarter of the 19th century, we've known that petroleum does not come from biological materials. And deeply entrenched in our culture is the belief that at some point in the relatively near future, we will see the last working pump on the last functioning oil well screech and rattle to its conclusion. And that'll be that. The end of the age of oil. And unless we find another source of cheap energy, the world will rapidly become a much darker and more dangerous place. Well, if Dr. Gold and Dr. Kinney are correct, this, the end of the world as we know it scenario, simply won't happen. Now think about it. While it's not inexhaustible, deep earth reserves of inorganic crude oil and commercially available extraction would provide the world with generations of low-cost fuel, and Dr. Gold has been quoted as saying that current worldwide reserves of crude oil could be off by a factor of more than 100. 100. That means that there would be 100 trillion barrels of oil, which would give us, oh gosh, 33-year supply. That would be 100. It would be a 3,300-year supply at our current rate of use. All right, boys and girls, that's the story on biodiesel and alternative fuels. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And for more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my website at georgegordon.org. Well, there's the signal. Says my time is up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.